Hello, welcome to the ZX Spectrum. My name's Lizzie Hodgson.
And my name's Brandon Ralph.
This week we've got a really interesting guest. I'll introduce them in a moment. But last week we covered off our TEDx talks. We deconstructed our TEDx talks and we explored the themes a little bit deeper. So you can check that out on the ZX Spectrum list of all of the other episodes that we have. But this week we have Mark Ash, who is CEO of Pure 60. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning, yes. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks
Good.
For having me.
It's well, you're welcome. So do you want to give a little bit of an introduction about yourself?
Yeah, so I am CEO of Pure 360. We're a marketing automation technology organization. I've been in digital marketing for the last 20 years. I stumbled into it. I began to train as a lawyer. And yeah, I was going to fight the world's ills and be a human rights lawyer. At the time, the internet was at its infancy, so it didn't really exist in marketing terms. When I graduated and wanted to get involved in marketing, I quite enjoyed the psychology of understanding people and how they make decisions. And just, you know, from a corporate perspective, that was quite appealing. Joined a marketing agency, started twiddling with their internet website.
And what year was this?
This was 99.
Okay.
So this was just
so before I was born.
Before you were born.
Were you double?
This is before double click. So this was a small agency, and it was an offline agency doing market research in very traditional ways. We used to fax surveys to our customers.
Wow.
We used the fax machine. Absolutely.
Do you know what a fax machine is, Brandon?
Yeah, like it's, you know, you get those 3-in-1 printers, and one of them's fax.
Yes.
But I've never used fax. Never plugged it. I know it goes into a phone line.
I mean, that time, that was the start of email. We used to have a single inbox for the entire company, receiving emails from all kinds of different people across the world, and it was a completely new experience. You took every single email seriously. But from there, I was approached to join a new company called DoubleClick, this newfangled thing called advertising, online advertising. And from there, kind of moved into a completely new realm and, you know, trained myself in new technologies and marketing disciplines, and the rest is kind of history, really.
So. You've worked with some very big companies, Virgin
yes.
Media, BT, TMN. So
yeah.
how did you progress through them?
It's been an interesting journey, and one that you couldn't really plan for. I think it was a case very much of being in the right space at the right time, of being open to learning new things. New disciplines, you know, I went from learning about our own company website and coding on the fly. So I was a self-taught coder and DBA, just because nobody knew how to do it. You kind of fell into that role because I thought, this is quite interesting. And I want to get to know about this. I want to be in control of my environment. So I picked up coding, and from that, I got approached for this position in London for DoubleClick. From that, I learned about advertising. From that, I learned about email marketing, which is a brand new thing. So I think just making yourself available and having curiosity to learn new things was really important for me, picking up new roles and then people thinking, well, this guy's useful, you know. And
do you think that approach, that curiosity, do you think that at the time was quite usual or unusual? Because I think that this is something that I'm quite interested in, like as in the workplace, this idea that we should be curious about what we do.
I certainly think it is undoubtedly important nowadays, more so than it has been in the past, simply because of the rate of progress and change that technology has driven for all organisations, for society in general. It certainly picked up that pace, and Moore's Law, I think, stands the test of time in that summary of how it's impacted our lives. But certainly, at the time, you could continue in that same job for 20 years and, you know, enjoy your pension and fine. But I think for me, it drove even more curiosity. I joined DoubleClick, which is highly innovative. It gave me new experiences. I travelled the world. I ventured into new technologies. It was changing every 6 months. Now, as a 20-something, that was so exciting. And then I joined BT, and I thought, oh my God, I've just stepped back in the past. Why on earth would I want to stay at this organisation and just to collect my pension after 20 years? It fed an ongoing curiosity, which I had to kind of feed with different experiences, and I always felt that moving to new positions, I had to be learning something new, otherwise I'd go stale. And I think that reflects often in the expectation of generations today. They expect continuous development, and that's why there's less loyalty to the typical jobs that you would see lasting 10, 15, 20 years.
I think that's absolutely bang on. And also I think very interesting that you were doing this 20 years ago. I think that's very...
I think I was very lucky to be given that opportunity to expand my curiosity because I didn't have that training. Yes, I was a bit of a geek. You've got to have a bit of a penchant for getting into the weeds of technology and make mistakes. But the good thing is, because nobody knew much, it was okay to make mistakes, learn and develop from that. You know, I remember crashing our file server in our and obviously that brought the whole company down, but not many people knew more about the tech than I did, but I had to learn quickly and adapt and move on. And I think there's an element of new organisation, new startups, where it is about learning new things, fail fast, learn and move on, and your growth curve as an organisation is much quicker as a result. You just simply cannot afford to rest on your laurels. You always have to have a commitment to a fast development pace.
So do you want to quickly explain what Pure 360 is to somebody who absolutely has no idea?
We call ourselves a provider of marketing automation and personalization technology. We provide that to e-commerce brands or any online brands, really. That allows them to automate the scheduling of messaging and communication to their clients and to personalize the content of those messages according to the specific needs and wants of those consumers. And to kind of give you an example, you think of any events that occur during a purchase process of buying something online, whether you leave something in your basket, you get a reminder email, you know, you've left this on your basket, here's 10% offer if you want to complete that transaction.
Do people game that though?
What do you mean?
You might be offered 10% off if you just leave it there for a while.
Yeah, so I'm
do something I would do.
Yeah. Undoubtedly, and I think certainly with generations that have grown up with those kind of marketing tactics that are employed, there is the expectation that that's expected. But ultimately, these tactics should be used as a trade-off for loyalty. If you demonstrate that lot, it's a quid pro quo. Give me your details, I'll send you personalised offers and I will treat you as a loyal customer to come back and buy. And so long as the economics of that work commercially, then it's a proven tactic that's worked actually for centuries, just in a different format online.
I think for me, whenever, and you'll know this, Lizzie, whenever we go anywhere or anything like that, I'm always a stickler for like deals and things like that. I think when we went to London last, we went to a restaurant and I paid like half the price. And I suppose I'm in a habit now of I never like pay full price for anything. Mm-hmm. Like I went to London the other week and I went and bought like a Groupon voucher to go out for a restaurant there. And I think brands can kind of, definitely with the youth and lots of brands, like the discount I mentioned in London, we got like through like student discount and things like that. And that for me builds up, like I would never go into these places. For example, Bellitalia, which I now go to quite a lot. I would never go in there to start with unless I had sort of the offer and the code for it.
But this is the beauty of those tactics and why they work, because for you personally, brands are really, really interested at getting your eyeballs effectively, getting you to experience them, try new experiences in the hope that they'll establish ongoing loyalty throughout your life later on. For someone like me, well, I've experienced quite a few things. Now I've got established brand loyalty with quite a few different brands that I trust, I know, I always have a regularly good experience with. Now for me, it's about making sure I continue that effectively, that chain of loyalty.
Mm.
You know, but for you, it's about, I want to try new things. Have you tried this? Have you tried that? Wow, this is marvellous. And from that, you start to curate a shortlist of your chosen brands over a given period of time.
I think one of the examples that comes to my head is, I think it was about a year and a half ago now, on the Three, which is the phone provider, have an app called 1-2, and you can get offers on that. And they did this like meal for £1. So you could go in and have a meal for like £1. In I think, because Bellitalia, Cafe Rogue, and Le Agandas, I think that's how you say it. They're all owned by the same company, but they're different brands.
Iguanas, I think. Like, I can't remember. Yeah, brands.
And they did, you could go there and have a meal for £1 each. Now, I think the interesting thing for me that came off of that campaign was the fact that I tell that as a story. It's like a funny thing that happened, that we went in there for like £1. And it's something that, because me and my friend, well, we met up for lunch and we went to three different places for £1 each. one after the other.
Yeah.
So we went to like Bella Italia first, had a pizza, we went for a burger, and then we went for a burrito. And I think that built in our heads that sort of idea. And now I regularly sort of go to Bella Italia in Brighton and things like that. And I think it's been extremely important. It builds that brand loyalty. Mm. And in my work, we do lots of that, because when you're younger, you sort of build the brands that you're going to, you know, stick with for the rest of your life, in essence. I mean, as you can probably see by my things, I'm a bit of an Apple guy. And I think the brands that build up today, the bigger, what I've seen and what some of the research I've seen from Gen Z is that bigger brands seem to succeed in the way that they can engage people younger and they can build sort of lifelong customers out of them. Obviously, we haven't quite seen the impact of Gen Z yet, but they are meant to maintain a lot of their buying power in the next 5 to 10 years, consumer spending. And I think the brands that have started really early to start to target them really, really early on are going to be sort of continuing for a long, long time.
I have mixed views on that. I think the big brands have financial muscle and that capability to be able to pivot and change more so than, say, other brands.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what we say in marketing is the customer experience is the new battleground.
Mm-hmm.
That comes in different forms. It's not just necessarily, say, monetary reward or discounts. It's about creating the most engaging, interactive, rewarding experience for consumers of a particular brand.
I think also brands are very much understanding the value of their, you know, what their culture is and what they stand for,
yes,
and their ethics, mm-hmm, around those kinds of, I mean, you know, around people. And I think that's very important, particularly for young people. But I think it's seeping out to a lot of people now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely. I think the work I do in sort of the HR industry, we're seeing a lot more now. Young people are driven by what the company culture is, because there's so many different companies now. You know, so they want to be in the technology industry. There's a lot of companies in the technology industry, but it's the ones that have the interesting cultures and the new and different things that keep them engaged. And I think you make a really good point in the fact that marketing sort of is around that. And I think lots of brands, and I'm going to go back to Apple because I'm a, you know, fanboy of Apple, is the idea that Apple, and they've recently sort of rehedged that, is that they put like privacy first. They want to be like the only they want to be the main company that puts users' data and privacy first, and they're putting a big push on that. And then they also do stuff with environmental and things like that. And from what I've seen from the youth is that idea that things like that are just as important as, say, the offer posting.
I completely understand that sentiment. Apple putting users' privacy first, I'm a little bit more sceptical about. If they were really putting user privacy first, then they would put it into the open sphere. And I think that the advent of things like blockchain and AI truly democratize consumer data. And this is the value of email, which I'll come on to later. But and in marketing terms, marketers see just how much ethics, culture of an organization, things like sustainability, what brands stand for, and with that authenticity is really, really key. There's a lot of brands that claim to this, that and the other, but actually their actions say something completely different.
And also, because we are a little bit older than brand, we can remember when Apple wasn't seen as that. You know, we can have those conversations. And the values that, I think this is about brand values, this is about the organisational values. They can be surface, but it won't take much to scratch below the surface to find out, you know, so there's, I mean, with Apple, you're talking about, you know, the factories, you know,
mm-hmm,
the human rights abuses that are happening,
mm-hmm,
in some of the factories. Oh, they've been surface that this is happening. So there has to be, when it comes to kind of like marketing and integrity of your message, they have to be quite careful, because you can't say one thing and then you know that there's this, you know, whole other stuff that it just is scratched on the surface, they'll be found out. So I think that's what's interesting about kind of, you know, when you are looking at brand values, they will ultimately get found out. And I think that's a good thing, you know, and I think that we have to keep challenging and keep challenging and challenging.
Absolutely. I think Gen Z is much, much more discerning nowadays than the Gen X. We kind of stumble upon technology, but wow, isn't this a wonderful thing? So kind of goggle-eyed with the power of new tech rather than Gen Z, their expectation levels are much higher because they've grown up with it. The bar has already been set, so they have to be more discerning. And they've also grown up with fake news, fake social media, fake influence. And so they have to curate their sources of data and information, inspiration, a lot more than we have had, I think, in Gen X. Yeah.
And I find as well, and I don't know if you've seen this similarly in your field, but the difference between millennials and Gen Z is Gen Z seem to be a lot more aware of when they're being advertised to.
Mm-hmm.
So millennials, you can advertise, and this is one of the things that I always key to try and get across when I'm going to agencies and stuff, is millennial methods will sort of work with Gen Z in the way that, you know, online adverts work in that way, but their effectiveness is a lot lower, purely on the basis that Gen Z are like, wait a second, this is an advert, and they're a lot more aware of the fact that, oh, you've put an advert in the middle of my Instagram feed, whereas millennials will just kind of like
absolutely
see it as content.
Absolutely.
And that makes it kind of a bit more difficult to target Gen Z, but I don't think it necessarily makes it more expensive or anything like that. I think it makes you just have to shift the way you do it into a different way and almost accept the fact that they know it's going to be an advert, but then use that almost as a pivot for an advantage.
So with so many marketing channels available, how do you ensure email marketing stays relevant?
Well, I think relevance is the key bit here. Email's been around, it's the longest, the longest surviving channel. And it continues to grow. And there was a recent study which showed that Gen Z preferred brand contact through email above all other channels.
To be honest, I could generally quite agree with that personally. Because I get hundreds and hundreds of emails a day. I still open every single one and have a look.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on, you know?
I think there's expectations around, I mean, every single time a new device is released or a new touch point, there's always a bandwagon in marketing. Well, this is the new thing, this is going to be the email killer, blah, blah, blah. But for me, email, A, is not owned by anyone. It's not like you're having a conversation on somebody else's website. So it feels like there's a bridge between a one-to-one between consumer and a brand, which is inviolable. You know, that isn't owned by anyone, that you can have, you conduct all of your admin, all of that. The trust is at the heart of this. You know, for that purpose, you can use it to manage your life within an email inbox. So this integrity is absolutely key. Now, it's not the most conversational medium of communication, but it's just about using the right medium for different types of communication.
And that, I think that's, you hit the nail on the head with that. Email is never going to be conversational in that respect. You know, you have a thread, you have, you know, but that's not what it's built for. And I think people understand that that's not what it's not built for. You have other things.
Well, you say that, Lizzie, but things are changing.
Are they
so
now?
They absolutely are. So Google actually announced this morning that they are enabling more interactivity or engagement in the email inbox. What that means, we'll wait and see, but effectively they've been launching Google Accelerator mobile pages for email
right. For
the last couple of years. And what this enables marketers to do is to effectively execute scripted language or greater interactive functionality
right. Directly
with the body of email.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that we are looking at a future where you can conduct all of your transactions directly from the body of the email.
Right.
That means you don't even, you know, the browser becomes, I will hasten to say, redundant for
it becomes the internet within.
Comes within the internet.
The email is the internet with it, you know.
I find that as a really interesting evolution as well, because Google are also working on, and it completely, the name completely leaves my head, but the idea that they're making even apps now in browser and be able to work out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of see that as like almost everything shifting along into more of like a condensed and singular system.
Absolutely.
And, you know, for me, the most interesting, the thing that I kind of value about email, interestingly, even though I don't use it too often, but it's the sort of unsubscribe button.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the fact that I, in some ways, am choosing...
You're in control.
I'm in control
of
all that. So when I use Facebook and Google services, for example, you can go through and have a level of control if you wanted to.
It's very difficult and intrusive.
It's
hidden.
But you really have to go
through it, whereas with an email, it's like, there it is, unsubscribe.
If a brand suddenly tries to contact me far too often for my liking, you know, I unsubscribe from them. That's that's the fact of the matter. And I can stop that getting through. And that's one of the key benefits from an email from me, is the fact that although I get 200 emails a day, I know that I mostly want to read, maybe not more, especially not Lizzie's emails. No, but I find that I can curate and be a lot more in control of what I do about it.
That is, we've gone through this regime as email marketers because of spam that has, I would say, really cleaned up the industry and put it in control. GDPR is just a reinforcement of those rules, but effectively, it creates a value exchange. If I give my email data and I tell you what my preferences are, then you've got the responsibility to deliver me relevant content. And that, for me, is something that brands should never shy away from, but embrace and actually do more about that. Ask consumers what they want. Do they like this content? Do they tell me what you're interested in? Tell me what your future buying behaviours are so I can give you exactly what you want.
I think it's really interesting around that as well, because it is the place you are having a conversation might be a little bit too much of a, not quite all. That you have said that there is some two-way happening, but you are having that direct communication. It's not through a Twitter that you hope will appear in somebody's feed.
Absolutely.
It's not through a post on Facebook that you know 1,000 other people will see as well. It's quite a personal
Absolutely.
Channel.
Mm.
And I think that's why I love email. There, I've said it. I love email. I find it the most engaging and personal way of communicating through work and through and newsletters and hearing from organisations. It is because I know it's within that and it's within the system. And as Brown says, if you don't like it, you can unsubscribe, which also keeps, as you say, keeps them on their toes. They have to make sure that they're doing good stuff.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's big brands that I have literally just unsubscribed from. And they may not necessarily have just lost me as a customer, but they've definitely lost that ability to market because they've oversaturated my inbox. If you send me an email every morning and I've explicitly said that I don't really want an email every morning, or the fact that I don't click on the links within your email should be a sign to you that I don't need that email every morning. I value, and I did this recently, I did a bit of consultancy work for a charity, Young Enterprise, that I know Lizzie and I do some work with. And we were talking about sort of their working on their alumni network. And they were like, how often should we send young people emails? And my answer was probably about 4 times a year. Because I would say I would much prefer you to spend 3 months working on the best content possible for me to sit and read, rather than you sending me an email every week giving me small micro updates. I'd much prefer to have you produce something valuable and have it in my inbox sort of a few times.
Well, this is where context and relevance is absolutely key, and not just emailing for the sake of it. It's absolutely part of the value exchange. And I think GDPR not only just refocuses the email marketer, but with the advent of more automation, so we're sending, I would say, overall as an industry, fewer emails, but for specific event-based purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So an event has happened where the consumer has asked for it. So
higher
it's more
quality.
Pull rather than push. Higher quality,
higher quality.
More contextually relevant.
Yeah.
That has shifted the focus on the quality of content, which makes us more creative, which really raises the bar. And so today's marketer has to focus on creativity rather than the process of getting out a newsletter just for the sake of it. There's absolutely no value in that.
And it's the value for me. I subscribe for an upcoming podcast project that I'm doing to lots and lots of news newsletters, which is a bit of a tongue twister. But in essence, and what I look for in the best ones, and some of the best ones, like one of my favourites at the moment, is by a Verge editor called Casey Newton. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. But he does like a daily news sort of letter on sort of his opinions of the news today. And that, for me, I find extremely valuable in the sense that it's one of those that I allow to, like, that I'm happy to get an email from every single day.
Yeah.
And he does it in the basis is because he makes something that's engaging and that's of interest to me. And I think now we have such a wide variety, new sector of, like, content of ones we can subscribe to. It's about, like, picking your favourites. And there's some that, and I'm not going to name any that I don't really like, but there's some that I dislike more than others, and those I've got my like preferences set to like, oh, you can email me like once a week or whatever, and I think it's just that mixture of in between.
Yeah.
So how do you reckon email marketing is going to change in the next 12 months?
Well, I mean, we've already alluded to the fact it's going to get more interactive,
yeah.
which means that the role of email will change.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about instant messaging, the rise of WhatsApp and other functions like that, I think where we are anticipating the hybridization of those kind of models, which adds a level of interactivity in email that we've not seen before. You think about the email as almost like a live to-do list. It's like an organizer. And people use email as reference points. All of my important documents are in email. It becomes a document store. If I, I remember that offer I got last month. It's still in my inbox. I just quickly searched there.
That's what I didn't
like. It's multifunctional in its usage beyond just the communication. But the enhancement of interactivity will I think see it replace the browser as where we spend the majority of our time. Everyone uses email on mobile. That's the biggest use of mobile is actually email usage, not calling. I think we'll see with the advent of blockchain, the true validation of one-to-one communication so that spam will become a thing of the past.
Are you experimenting with anything, Pure 360?
Well,
that you can speak about?
Yeah, well, we already use AI for decisioning when it comes to content selection, offer selection, product matching for particular profiles of consumers.
Mm-hmm.
That's already incorporated. We use AI to do a lot of heavy lifting on a lot of data processing work, which is what it's ideally used for at the minute. I see, and we are looking at a roadmap of activity to take that a step further, to do a lot more of the heavy lifting around the processing and the decisioning around when is the right time to send an email or an SMS or a particular message to a user. Now, this gets away with the whole concept of the regular monthly newsletter because that ceases to be of any value. You know, you ultimately...
It's quite arbitrary.
It's quite arbitrary.
Day.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
That time and that,
still,
but based on maybe some intel, but it's not accurate intel.
I see some brands that I don't really follow them anymore that they will send me an email, I think, like at the same time on the same... Like the same day,
because
month,
yeah,
the week.
Because
statistically,
right,
you know,
yeah,
it's that right time.
So you're using AI to actually drive that in a different way.
Yes, I mean we're looking to use AI to help us in deciding what is the optimal content to send, when is the right time to send it, and to use the data that consumers have given us, their control metrics, effectively on how they want to engage with the brand, and that's important. You have to allow everyone to be a part of that control. As you were saying before, you've got to invite consumers in to say, I want this then, I want this, I prefer to have this then, this is the stuff that excites me. It's an emotional value exchange, and your use of intelligent automation is much, much better if you have that data involved in that decision process.
So I just want to pull out AI a little bit more because I'm... absolutely fascinated with AI. It's a big,
I'm very excited.
I know it's very difficult to sort of like future, even like a year or 2 years down the line. How important is AI going to be to your industry?
I think we are only scratching the surface. AI at the minute, unfortunately, is a bit of a bandwagon that everyone jumps on commercially. You say the word AI and all of a sudden, how amazing. Well, actually, it's not. It's a lot of business rules. You know, that's dressed up as AI.
Implementing it and trying it and testing it, and it takes time to...
It takes time. It takes a huge amount of data
to
actually see a degree of sophistication. But using it for heavy lifting, it's incredibly useful. I think that we see a huge amount of usage with AI replacing standard roles, which are very process-orientated for marketing. Now, that's quite scary. But it also is quite exciting because what it does is it focuses the mind of the marketer on being creative. Now, AI has struggled to, I think, deliver what is truly human, which is actually our idiosyncrasies, our shortfalls, our unpredictability.
Our rough edges.
Our rough edges. Well, that's what makes us human, is our failings. And there's an element of creativity which actually goes against data. Because data is obviously retrospective and backward looking and trend, but actually, you think about new trends, they always rebut, you know, things that happened previously.
Yeah.
Things that you can't predict around. That's what makes creativity so human.
The human element in all of this is with AI is going to become more and more important, and it's like that kind of that team human element of it. It does not detract from the amazing things that AI is going to do.
Absolutely.
But you have to put, I'm of the opinion that you put the human at the heart, not the tech at the heart.
Exactly.
And that for some is a little bit of a, you know, that it's counterintuitive because I think the technology is going to solve it all. Well, it isn't.
We're seeing that already. Yeah. You know, a lot of people put in place a lot of big tech and then expect it to solve their marketing problems. And you're like, well, you're just feeding it with the same
biases, the same problems,
and you're not ingesting new creativity, or you're not using the data to inform, how do I need to speak to Brandon and his friends? Have I really thought about that? What's the narrative?
Or some examples I've seen is they've used like data sets that they've used in the past, and they haven't progressed them onwards, so they're then trying to use old data, or data that's been driven in essence by sort of mistakes and stuff like that, that makes that you're basically teaching the algorithm how to make the same mistakes you made rather than building one that can allow you to evolve.
That is exactly pertinent. I mean, we historically as old marketers we use things like sociodemographic segmentation models.
Mm-hmm.
And today's Gen Z is more diverse than it ever has been.
Uh-huh.
There's no point in having those old models simply don't apply. So we spend a lot of time saying you need to collect the data which is informative of behaviour and context around future behaviours. And some of that is things like, I don't know, information related to people's how they feel. How do they react to a certain message? What's important to them from a values set perspective? You know, what's driving future behaviours? Why are they doing it?
And what's really interesting about that is in that approach, you are also seeing your customers as humans themselves.
Exactly.
Because it's around behaviours, around mm-hmm. feelings, around emotions, which is, we are those, that's the kind of creatures we are. And I say this a lot, Brandon has heard this, we say this in pretty much every single podcast, we're not binary, we're not made up of ones and zeros.
Absolutely.
So if we are approaching people like they are, then it's not going to really play out very well. And it'll, you know, it might work for some, but it's not going to be it's not a strategy that's going to work in the long term.
No, this is what I've seen in lots of agencies today, not necessarily ones that I work with. I've seen in the past and I've spoken to, is that they seem to be very stuck in their sort of old methods and not moving forward, but trying to trick themselves into the idea that they're moving forward by using flashy things like AI when it's not really AI and things like that. And I find that kind of like, oh, well, you know, I can see which ones are going to succeed. And I find it interesting that you note as well that lots of those levels is almost going to be pushed towards creativity rather than just, you know, the sort of day-to-day sort of chuck, which technology can easily take over. And I'm really interested to sort of hear at Pure 360 with the uprising sort of Generation Z that are just coming into the workplace. Do you have many Gen Zs in your team?
We do, but not enough, if I'm being honest. We are looking at future recruitment from looking at new ways of recruiting into our organisation. Historically, you've recruited people that have done that experience in those roles before. And we're beginning to question whether that is actually important, because for us, we spent a big exercise looking at our values, looking at the kinds of culture we wanted to create an organisation, kind of behaviours that we need to model to be the kind of organisation we need to be true and successful for our customers. And we found that what's the best ways of implementing that? And sometimes you need a fresh perspective, but you need to have a recruitment process which is focused around those values. And it's about creativity, being analytically minded, self-awareness, empathy, emotional intelligence, those adaptability. You know, our market changes every 5 minutes. If you can't be adaptable, then you can't have a fresh perspective on how the world's changing and what people need.
And the thing that I've noticed a lot more as well is it's not about having a school education, because I'm guessing at Pure 360, they don't teach you how to do probably what you do in school necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you mentioned the changes in email marketing, and we always discuss it in a year's time. So even if you go to university and get a degree that was written maybe even just the year that you started your course,
mm-hmm.
by the time you finished it 3-4 years later, it's already 3-4 years out of date.
Yeah.
And I found that we had a discussion a couple of weeks ago with a woman called Caroline from Further My Future, which you can go back and listen to. And we discussed about sort of apprenticeships
mm-hmm.
and things like that and how that does. So do you do apprenticeships at Pure 360?
We have done some in the past on piecemeal basis, but we're looking at doing a regular scheme. At a previous organisation at work, we had an internship scheme which worked really well.
Yeah. I think internships can also sometimes work. just as well as sort of apprenticeship.
It's a blended approach, isn't it? And one of the things that, you know, when I'm consulting into companies, it's like not one solution fits all.
Mm.
And also talent, I believe talent can be surfaced anywhere, but it's having that effort to go and find those untapped sources. And, you know, I'm not down on the education system as such, but I do think that it needs a major overhaul for many different reasons.
I've actually written a whole sort of post about, and we can go over that in another podcast.
We'll go over that in another podcast. but I think that one of the things is that it's also not really fair on the young people coming out of university.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they have been sometimes are misguided on what their expectations are
around
what work's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the time they think that they're going to, and this is where Brandon and I, you know, sometimes have a discussion, that they're going to fit into this place and it's going to be, you know, two or three steps above where usually you'd the entry point, and you'd have to learn, you have to graft, you have to learn things, you have to try things out, but it's part of a process. And I think that there's a disconnect between some organisations and the young people that are coming in.
Most organisations.
And that conversation has to be had, and managing young people's expectations, but also it's not just about the young people coming in. It has to be for the people that are in that organisation as well. You know, you've got, in any organisation worth its kind of like, you know, so it's going to have different generations in it, and every single one of them is just as valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So Generation Z isn't kind of like going to come in and then that's it, everything's going to change. There are, you know, people who've been in the industry 20, 30 years, and their insight is as valuable. The way they do things might need to change. And it's like kind of like, that, it again, comes that blended kind of culture.
And I think it comes down to as well, Gen Z being able to have voices within organisations and not being like, oh, you know, you're only 18. What do you think? Because I think we have such a different mindset and such a different thing. And, you know, the thing that keeps me in a job is the fact that at the moment, organisations really don't know the best way to engage.
Yeah.
And my aim is, because I'm Gen Z, I can, and because I am around Gen Z, or my friends are Gen Z, I have a good understanding. I spend my days looking at research at Gen Z and doing research myself and things like that, is the element of having conversation with Generation Z. And now for me, for organisations, sometimes I can be a good port of call because of my track record and the ability to do that. But also it's as well just talking to sort of your everyday Gen Z. Like, I think it's a lovely idea when I've been suggesting to some organisations is, you know, when you don't manage to hire a Gen Z person and it's on the basis that you failed rather than them failing, is, you know, having a conversation with them about why they don't want to work at your firm or what put them off. And, you know, very quickly they can learn an insight on having a shift, which I think the shift that Gen Z are looking for is quite a positive shift, not just for Gen Z, but for generations above.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more of a shift of sort of like open dialogues and things like that, and the sort of removal of big bureaucratic structures and having more of that. I don't think Gen Z necessarily want to jump into that high level. I think it's more of the basis that they want a voice, and they also want to be able to influence decisions more.
I think partly the issue is that the generational shifts in behaviour, not necessarily the physiological or sociological, but certainly technology has made them more marked in the difference of behaviour in the workplace. I think it's part of the problem is the flexibility that the business environment has. It's been very inflexible to adapt to those changes. So there's greater inference, there's a greater need for business owners to be more adaptable, to be more reflective, to be more diverse, and to give different groups of generations a bigger say in the running of the company. That's really difficult. As you were saying before, you know, I worked in a very, very corporate environment in Teradata or in BT, for instance. Very old-fashioned, very procedural recruitment and performance review process. It was very, very checkbox heavy. If you were, it was a black and white kind of scenario. Whereas now, we find this is not adding any value. Really, people contribute in different ways. We've got to be more explicit in terms of what people are doing to contribute. It's not necessarily output-driven. Other, you know, we have certain people that we shouldn't be valuing on output. It should be on what's their contribution to a debate? What is their contribution in terms of ideation, in terms of helping us adapt and transform, that, you know, is different nowadays. How flexible people, how well do they cope with adaptability in the modern marketplace? There's different skills and benefits and criteria that we need to assess our staff over time. So,
and I think the dynamic excites me as well is that Gen Z are able to do, like, we used to, I think the average screen amount we use is 1.8 screens at a time, which sounds a bit weird of a statistic, but in essence you say roughly we're using two screens at once. And I think that our ability to multitask, and not necessarily at the same time, but rather than just doing one position and one job, being able to do lots and lots of other positions.
I have one more question. What does empathy and purpose and work mean to you? That's a quick question.
Everything. I mean, you couldn't be an effective marketer without empathy. I would say probably the biggest characteristic need that we want as a big driver is empathy. Understanding is critical, not just to marketing effectiveness, but to working effectively in a complex organisation. And purpose, well, absolutely everyone needs to know their contribution to the success of an organisation. So I would say those two are the key characteristics. Self-awareness being another that we look for in new hires.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Where can people find out about Pure 360?
Come to our website, pure360.com, and read all about us and engage with ourselves.
You do quite a few downloadable kind of like info packs, don't you? And
yeah.
Kind of like guidelines and things like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Come to the website. There's lots of information about marketing. We also hold events where we invite speakers in just to give us fresh perspective on not just the industry, but as you say, on Gen Z and the world around us. It helps us become better informed marketers.
We'll put everything in the links.
Where can people find you, Lizzie?
You can find me on lizziehodgson.com.
And you can find me on brandonruff.com. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Brandon.
Thank you, Lizzie.
See you next time.